Morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This meeting of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee will now come to order. The time is now 8:02 a.m., Tuesday, March 7th, 2024, in Capital Room 106. Members present are Representative McKay, Representative Mears, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Hinshute, Representative McCabe, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before I begin, I would like to thank Sophia Tenney, the Committee Secretary for Records, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we will be hearing three bills. We'll be hearing an introduction on HB 5 by Representative Rauscher, HB 317 by Representative Carpenter, and then we will hear SJR 13 by Senator Dunbar. Representative Rauscher and staff, Ryan McKee, if you'd like to come forward, please brief at ease. On the record, Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee, please put yourself on the record and you can begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is George Rauscher, District 29 Representative. I'd like to thank the Chair of the Committee, Chairman McCormick, and I'd like to thank the committee members for hearing this bill today. An act relating to convening the legislature in Anchorage, House Bill 5. House Bill 5 will bring the legislative session to a place where most Alaskans can participate. Currently, the legislative session being held in Juneau is incredibly expensive for a constituent to participate in person. And while there are options to view meetings online, those options are few because of the actual ability to get online in some communities or to be able to sustain a long bandwidth. Moving the legislative session to Anchorage would provide Alaskans with a way to participate in the legislative process in person, like done in most states. In addition to making sessions more accessible to Alaskans, moving the legislature session to Anchorage would also help reduce the huge cost involving moving 53 legislators and many of their staff to and from Juneau each year. Furthermore, the session being held in Anchorage, a good portion of those legislators and staff would also not require housing. House Bill 5 will help bring down the cost of legislative session and give the public an opportunity to participate in the legislative process without having to spend large amounts of money in many more districts than are available at this moment. There are a few other things that I'd like to bring up, some interesting points. 30 legislators won't have to collect per diem. For the record, I am one of those who won't be able to collect per diem. They won't have to worry about IT, transporting their computers and electronics back and forth. They won't have files transported back and forth. They won't have to have storage units here in Juneau. They won't have to fly back and forth to district meetings during session. They won't have to fly back and forth for events like governor's energy events, RDC, and such that take place in the Anchorage area while we're down here, and other events that they miss. 22 legislators will not have to fly a second leg through Anchorage to get here. Constituents from 57 districts will not have to fly from Anchorage and take that second leg. So, or just take that second leg. So almost two dozen more, 30 districts. Constituents now will not have to pay for plane fare, expensive hotel stays, eat out at restaurants just to see their legislator during session, as paid lobbyists get to do. That's 30 times 18,000, which is 540,000 constituents. After constituents pay all those expenses, many never get to visit their legislator due to long floor sessions and committee changes. sometimes for as little, they only get to visit their legislator for as little as 15 minutes sometimes when they do, because it's so busy. Lobbyists have us captive here. They can afford to stay here, wait on their moment in the hallway, or chance to get to our office. If it didn't work today, it's tomorrow or later today. They don't have to worry about a flight getting out of here if they're really trying to get to our attention. They know our schedules. It's much easier for them to bump into us. 30 more legislators will be with their families at night where they live. They will be able to get back and forth to their district committee meetings in district a lot easier. Costs for moving cars back and forth will be greatly reduced. Costs for many other items will be greatly reduced. Anchorage has hosted a session already, so we know it's possible. Businesses and organizations will spend tens of thousands of dollars less to get their lobbyists down to Juneau to get our ear. Commissioners and directors will not have to fly to Juneau and collect per diem, spend travel pay, plane fare, and other lodging, saving the state millions. I'm going to turn this over to my chief of staff, Ryan McKee, who would probably go over the sectional with you.
All right. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. So a lot of this language is just changing the language currently in statute for moving this session. And again, this isn't moving the Capitol, it's just moving the legislative session. Section 1, AS 1513072D, this would change the location where a legislator or a legislative employee may not solicit or accept a contribution unless it occurs in a place other than the municipality of Anchorage, replacing the capital city during regular or special legislative session. Section 2, AS 1513-07G, this would change the location from the capital city to the municipality of Anchorage, where a candidate or an individual who incurs election-related expenses for election or re-election to the office of the governor or lieutenant governor may not solicit or accept contributions. Section 3, AS 2405-90, this would change the location of the legislative session to convene in the municipality of Anchorage, not the capital. Section 4, AS 2405.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Excuse me, Ms. Mary, I see that you have your teams unmuted. I apologize. You're not quite.
I'm so sorry.
That's quite all right. Happens all the time. Please continue. I apologize, Mr. McKee.
This would change the location of the legislative session to convene in the municipality of Anchorage, not the capital. Section 4, AS 2405-100B. This would change the location of a special session if the governor designates a location other than the municipality of Anchorage. Section 5, AS 2410-030. This would change the location for the chief clerk and Senate secretary to serve their duties at a location of the session until the completion of their work relating to that session. Section 6, AS 2410-130A, this would change the location of the legislative session to the municipality of Anchorage when handling the members' reimbursement of travel expenses from their place of residence. Section 7, AS 2445-041B, this would change a lobbyist's requirement to provide the temporary residential and business address in the location of the session instead of the state capital. Section 8, AS 2445-041E, this would change the location where the lobbyist directory shall be made available to the legislative chambers in the municipality of Anchorage. Section 9, AS 2450-010, this would change the location where annual students, guests may stay to the municipality of Anchorage. Section 10, AS 2450-040, this would change the location of the essay contest to the location of the session and adds that each legislative guest, quote, hosted under AS 2450-010 to further define the annual student guests. Section 11, AS 2460-030A, this would change the location where a legislator or legislative employee may not solicit or benefit other than official compensation or use public funds, facilities, equipment, services, or other government asset or resource for non-legislative purposes in the primary location of the session. Section 12, AS 2460031A. This would change the location from the capital city to the municipality of Anchorage, where an employee may or may not solicit or accept a contribution or promise or pledge to make a contribution. Section 13, AS 2460031B. This would change the location from the capital city to the municipality of Anchorage, where a legislator may or may not solicit or accept a contribution or promise. Section 14, AS 2460080C, this would change the location from the capital city to the municipality of Anchorage in relation to gifts. Section 15, AS 4499007, this would specify the location where the governor shall declare proclamation and emergency temporary locations or locations for the seat of government or for the session. And then Section 16, AS 4406050, 4406055, and 4406060 are repealed. And then Section 17 sets an effective date. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for the record, we are stating that we're not moving the Capitol. Okay, this is just relocating a legislative session with this bill. And I think there's a fiscal note in there. I'm not sure I understand the fiscal note, but I'm sure you could just rehire people in the Anchorage area. But I did want to make note that there is a fiscal note there. And appreciate anyone has any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. And Mr. McKee, are there any questions? Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in the other six times that somebody attempted to move the Capitol, this is different because this is only moving the session. The Capitol would stay in Juneau, but the session would move to Anchorage. Is that what's different this time?
That's correct. Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hemshute. Yes, correct.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I have a lot of questions about this. And I guess, is there any other state that has their capital, their legislative session meeting somewhere other than their capital?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, to Representative Hemshute, I do not know, but we can find out for you.
Follow-up,
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, can you help me understand why the capital of New York is not New York City, or why the capital of California is not Los Angeles?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I do not know at all.
Okay. I might have more questions later. Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Through the chair, I just make a comment that the Capitol is effectively already in Anchorage. The governor, most of his commissioners, if not all of them, have offices in the Atwood building. It appears to me that they spend most of their time in Anchorage already. So we may call Juneau the Capitol, but effectively all the officers of government are in Anchorage most of the time anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McCabe, excuse me, Vice Chair McCabe, did you have a question?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, you know of any other capital in the United States that's inaccessible to constituents by road?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, to Representative McCabe, I do not believe there are any other capitals that are non-accessible by road in the United States.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Follow-up, Vice Chair McCabe.
So the citizens of California can drive to Sacramento and the citizens of New York can drive to Albany. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative McKay, that's correct.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? We'll make one comment about Sacramento. I met a representative who lived in the Los Angeles area, and he told me that he actually has to fly to Sacramento because it's a fairly long drive. So, nonetheless, Representative Rauscher.
Through the chair, I appreciate your comment. Through the chair, Representative McKay, I have to say that maybe Hawaii there's a few islands out there where they may have to fly to their capital. So I do have to recant my statement.
Thank you.
But I do want to bring up the fact that the people of the state of Alaska more than once have voted to move the capital, and the reason they didn't never move it was because it was too expensive. This does not cost any money. This saves money, and this kind of does what they really wanted it to do anyway, was be accessible and have their legislators accessible to them during session. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I think speaking on behalf of my district, certainly it's been a highly asked of request. Why do we continue to have legislative sessions in Juneau? I think this is a relatively straightforward request that certainly holds a lot of emotion in it, and I think that may be one of the barriers to overcoming. But if you travel around Alaska to any level, I think there is a common theme, which is Juneau is very difficult to hold legislative session in. And so I appreciate this common sense approach, which is not moving the capital, but continuing to recognize that the people of Alaska do have a request. And that's been a request for quite some time, which is, is there a possibility to have a legislative session closer to where the people are at? One question that I do have is, I've had considerations from some folks that are trying to thread the needle, so to speak, where there's the potential to hold, since we have two times we come to Juneau for one legislative session. The thought was to hold one of those sessions in Juneau and one of those in Anchorage to give people a opportunity to both keep some of the infrastructure in Juneau, because there is state offices and all that, to Representative McKay's point. Some of those things that exist in Anchorage do exist in Juneau. I wonder what your thoughts would be on holding one half of session in Anchorage, one half in Juneau, if that was something that you had considered at all.
Representative Rauscher. District 29, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. I have never considered that, but if you were to ask me what I thought of it, I would have to say that the list of things that I read off all would pertain, except for the years that we were still in Juneau. And so that amount of savings would not take place while we were in Juneau. I think one of the things that you would have to do differently was there's some staffing in Juneau that belonged to the legislator, not to the legislators. And I believe that staffing would complicate it for them, only because they'd actually have to move away instead of the legislators moving back and forth. And I think that's the major change that you would see, because you don't want to just keep hiring every year new people to work in two different communities. So I think that might be a bit of a, and I think there's 40 in this fiscal note that they talk about that may have to do that if you did that every other year. Otherwise, I think you'd just be, they would either move to Anchorage or you'd be hiring new staff in Anchorage, is my apparent understanding. If that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Himshut.
Thank you, through the chair. Rep. Rauscher, it's an intriguing idea, for sure. I guess it feels a little bit like we have a level playing field in Juneau, because only three people serving are actually going home at night to their family. And so if we were to relocate, then a lot more people would be going home to their family. And I don't know, that comes at the cost of time and attention, but at the great benefit of support, you're home with your family. So I feel like Juneau's done a lot to accommodate us. So I'm going to have to really think about this a whole lot. And I guess it feels like it's been voted on so many times. It's hard to think that we need to even be looking at this again. I have other questions, but I'll just save those for now. Thanks.
Any further discussions or comments? Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee, do you have any closing remarks before we set this aside?
Representative Rauscher, for on the record, to our Chair McCormick, I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard. It's been brought forth a lot of times, and I don't know if it's ever been heard, but it has actually been heard. I appreciate the fact that this committee was willing to hear it. And I appreciate the fact that you were willing to do that also. I do want to thank the committee for that.
Thank you for presenting this morning. I guess what I'll disclose in saying, it's quite a problem we have here in the state of Alaska. Many, many communities who really can't visit the Capitol. I know in my own experience, I have a number of friends who've only been to Anchorage once or twice in their life. And so that is really an issue of equity. So I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what can I do for the villages that I represent? You know, they're still kind of out of this equation. So it's an interesting thought exercise. So,
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
I don't know if everybody recognizes how many times I stand up to introduce guests. Very seldom. And I know they really like to come and talk to their legislator.
All right. Well. Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee, I want to thank you again for this presentation. We will now set HB 5 aside. We now welcome Representative Carpenter and staff to speak on HB 317. If you'd please come forward, put yourself on the record, begin your presentation. I also neglected to note, I apologize, Representative Hannon joined us at the beginning of the meeting as well.
Way to clear the room.
What happened?
Farms.
I know my place, I guess. Good morning, Chair McCormick and committee. It is good to be with you this early morning. I want to open up with some comments about why we're bringing this bill forward, and then I will turn the presentation over to my staff. So for the record, this is Representative Carpenter. I represent District 8, which is the northern Kenai Peninsula outside the Kenai-Soldotna metropolitan areas. Before the advent of discovery of oil, Alaskans were much more self-sufficient with regard to food, kind of out of necessity. And once we became wealthy with oil, it became easier to just import food than it is to go through the effort of growing food. You fast forward to today, and very few people actually grow their own food. And that has presented a problem to Alaskans who rely on food at their grocery store when we have supply chain disruptions and the shelves are bare. There has been a push in recent years to figure out ways to make us more self-sufficient and food secure in the state. And I have participated on the Food and Farm Caucus for a number of years, looking for different ways to incentivize or change Alaska and how tenuous our food supply is. In I think it was 2016, I had the opportunity to travel with the Alaska Army National Guard to South Korea. And my duty assignment was about halfway down the Korean Peninsula, and I took a small bus down. And what was shocking to me was that as soon as you got outside the Seoul metropolitan complex, the entire drive down outside of the city areas, and right up next to the city areas, as far as the eye could see, you would see high tunnels, greenhouses and rice paddies. And South Korea has a climate where it gets cold in the wintertime, and they have invested in the infrastructure to extend their growing season and produce food. And I don't know, haven't done the research to know whether that's food production just for their own people or whether they're exporting it. Maybe there's a combination there. The point is that those people have made a deliberate decision to dedicate land use to growing food. And that is in stark contrast to Alaska. We have not made that decision. So the question is, how do we change that? Well, we don't want to live in a country where the government puts a heavy hand down and says, you will grow a garden. But we do live in a country where we can incentivize activity that we would like to see happen. And thus, House Bill 317 was born. So one of the issues that we have as farmers is that when you take the land that you purchase, and it may not be zoned as farmland or treated as farmland for tax purposes, it may be residential, and you put a structure up like a greenhouse, and the property tax assessment treats that greenhouse as a structure on a residential lot, then the property tax that's levied is more than it would be if we structured our taxes in a such way that agriculture use was a smaller tax burden. So what House Bill 317 does is attempt to incentivize the growth of agriculture by reducing the tax burden on agriculture use on our lands. And I think that's an important piece of incentivizing the activity that we really want, which is people to grow more food. We do have a problem with food production at a commercial level to make sure that we have groceries in our stores consistently. But that isn't just the only problem we have. We have a problem with people not knowing how to grow food. And that is solvable. It is knowable. It's not difficult. And it is something that the government can incentivize for people to do. So this is a proposal to do just that. So for an explanation of the bill, I will turn my time over to my staff here, and she will introduce herself.
For the record, my name is Kendra Broussard, SAFTA Representative Carpenter. Through the chair, I'll read through the sectional analysis. So Section 1 amends property tax exemptions for farm use structure by removing the requirement that a person engaged in farming derive at least 10% of the person's yearly gross income from farming. Section 2 amends farm use land assessment statute to add structures for farm purposes. Section 3 amends farm use land assessment statute to remove requirements for first-time farmers to file intended percentage of income, as that requirement is being removed from law. Section 4 amends farm use land assessment statute by removing the requirement that a person engaged in farming derive at least 10% of the person's yearly gross income from farming. Section 5 repeals the ability to waive for crop failure the 10% of income requirement, as that requirement is being removed from law. Section 6 adds to the uncodified law a provision mandating that any municipality failing to adopt an ordinance either partially or completely exempting farm structures from property taxation must, at the subsequent regular election, present to the municipality's voters the question of whether to implement a total exemption for farm structures utilized in farming activities. And Section 7 provides an effective date of July 1st, 2025. And then I will go through a presentation. So Alaska is the largest U.S. state, yet it has one of the smallest agricultural industries, according to the USDA. As such, the food supply does not yet meet demand. Alaska relies heavily on imported food and is thus more vulnerable to interruptions in the food import supply chain. Currently, only 5% of the food Alaskans consume is produced in Alaska. House Bill 317 is a proactive measure designed to foster a favorable environment for agricultural growth and sustainability in Alaska. By providing tax incentives for farm structures and preserving farm use land, we aim to incentivize farming practices, stimulate economic activity, and strengthen our food production systems. Alaska's supply chain is vulnerable, and in turn, our food supply is unstable, of which 95% of purchased foods are imported. Extreme weather events and seasonality make rural communities far beyond the end of the road, susceptible to weeks without food delivery, and the food that arrives often has a high spoilage rate due to long travel time and poor storage conditions. Additionally, by importing most of our food supply, around $2 billion is sent out of the state each year. Alaska is past due for activating a strategic approach to creating a more inclusive, equitable, and resilient food system for all. So what's hindering Alaska's agriculture? Startup challenges, sustainability challenges, marketing issues, business plans, access to affordable and adequate land. Promising efforts that are underway currently are seaweed supply, farmers markets, and food hub activity, room for growth, current economic impact. So currently there are agricultural tax breaks in the U.S. so you don't have to be a full-time farmer to take advantage of a variety of agricultural tax breaks that will help you with your property taxes. In some cases, all you need is a piece of land that's not currently being used. You can use the land to preserve timber, for example, or put it in some kind of agricultural use to save on property taxes. The size of agricultural property tax exemptions varies from state to state. Qualifications for agricultural tax exemptions vary from state to state, too. Some states base eligibility on the size of the property, while others set a minimum dollar amount for agricultural sales of goods produced on the property. Many use of combinations of gross sales and acreage requirements, grazing a single cow on your property can be enough to trigger tax breaks in some places. If you qualify, an agricultural tax exemption can knock thousands off your property tax bill. Depending on your state's rules, one way to execute this tax strategy is to offer use of your land to a local farmer. For example, you could allow a nearby farmer to harvest hay on acres you're not using or rent your land to a farmer. You don't necessarily have to do the work yourself to claim the exemptions for your property. So those are some different tax breaks in other states. Current agricultural tax breaks in Alaska. Alaska Statute 29.45 allows for commercial farmland to be assessed for property tax purposes as farmland rather than if the land was used for some other purpose. Alaska Statute 29.45 allows municipalities to allow voters to approve reduced tax rates for farm structures used for farming activities. House Bill 317 ensures that not only farm use land, but also structures dedicated to farming operations are assessed based on their agricultural value. Rather than being subject to taxation as if used for non-agricultural purposes, this provision safeguards the integrity of agricultural land and supports its continued use for farming activities. HB 317 also removes the requirement that farm use land or structures be used for commercial activities to lower the barrier of entry for startup farmers and small operation, which encourages growth in both commercial farming and farming to feed your family and community. Current statute gives municipalities the authority to partially or fully exempt farm structures used exclusively for farming activities from taxation. This exemption applies to structures engaged in various farming-related functions, such as crop production, feed storage, and dairy operations. HB 317 requires municipalities who do not currently give tax rate exemptions for farm use structures to place a partial or total tax exemption before their voters in the next general election. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Representative Carpenter and Ms. Broussard. Are there any questions or comments, I guess? Representative Mears.
Thank you. Through the chair, I've got a lot of things brewing in my mind with questions. And I know that we can have some of this conversation offline as well, but some of my initial thoughts here are the applicability of the local assessors to be able to execute assessments on very small and potentially temporary operations that homeowners are doing, because it's my understanding that we want to encourage all sorts of people in all sorts of circumstances to be working in local food production for themselves as well. And I saw a lot of interest in gardening tick up during the pandemic, and there's a group called Anchor Gardens in Anchorage that sprung up, and a lot of people started getting into agriculture, you know, not full on agriculture, but, you know, growing things in their own yards and so forth. And money certainly was not a motivating factor there. I'm a little concerned that this bill goes a little too fine on that point, and that the ability of the assessment to be able to fully capture that and be beneficial. I don't know that I have a question. It's just a concern.
Through the chair, if I may respond, the assessors go to property and assess periodically, regularly. And if a property owner were to install a structure, a greenhouse, where one did not exist, the assessor would be able, not be able, they would change the property value assessment of that piece of property because that structure was added to the overall property structure. So they already do this on a regular basis. Build a greenhouse, you're going to pay more taxes on your property tax because it's an improvement to the land. By addressing how the assessors do their assessment and saying that if you're going to put an agriculture-related structure that's used for agriculture, you have to compare it to agriculture-related property, not other like residential property for valuation purposes. And that's just giving direction to the assessors on how they do their assessment. And that is to bring down the value assessment on what those greenhouses are, how they're assessed. The second part of the bill addresses the tax rate portion by requiring the local municipality to come up with a plan for a tax rate reduction for agriculture use of their structures. So either partial or full tax rate reduction for structures in their within their jurisdiction. Both of those mechanisms would have an impact on local municipal tax tax rolls. Current statute allows for those tax rolls, the reductions to be covered by state funds. So the way that we would incentivize people to put up a greenhouse is by helping them with the cost of the construction of the greenhouse with lowering of their tax burden. And that's the incentive piece for what the government can do, because we can't force somebody to put a greenhouse up, but we can encourage them through a reduction in property tax that they have to pay if they put those buildings up. So we're just addressing how the assessor assesses those agriculture buildings and then what the tax rate is for agriculture related property.
Follow up, Representative Mears.
Thank you to the chair. Just to follow up, I'd love to have further conversations about case studies in other places. It looks like there's some of this. There's an example of a single grazing cow could trigger some of these tax exemptions. So if you've done some of that research, I would love to take a look at it. Thank you.
I'm sure we're willing to have a conversation anywhere we need to.
Representative Hemshire, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you. Through the chair, Rep. Carpenter, I better understand now what you're trying to get at. You're trying to incentivize all of us to grow more of our own food. And I think where my confusion came in is the definition of agriculture, because I'm concerned about taking away any threshold to define an operation as an agricultural operation. So if you could clarify for me, when we say agriculture, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm producing something to share out. Agriculture can also be producing something, just my own garden for my own consumption.
Representative Henshute, I'm not, through the chair, I am not changing the definition of agriculture or agricultural use that is currently in statute. So those definitions are already there. But you are correct. What this bill is intending is to remove the distinction in statute that we're incentivizing only commercial activity and incentivizing all agriculture activity.
Follow up, Representative Henshute.
Yeah, follow up. Through the chair, so I guess a concern that I had when I first read the bill is that anybody could have a cultivated raspberry bush, call it agriculture, and no longer be paying the regular property tax. I'm concerned about the burden on communities of everybody taking advantage of this and suddenly having a lower tax burden. Can you clarify, and maybe it's in here, but since you're here, I'm just going to ask, is it only the structure, like if I put a raspberry bush out, I am not making my property into a farm because I'm growing a bush for my own consumption. It has to be an actual structure to receive the tax break. Is that correct?
The addition to the statute is in regards to structures. The definition of farm use land is still currently in the statute, and that would cover a myriad of activities. We can probably get the definition for you and for the committees. I think we probably have that with us. The point that I would like to just point out is that if everybody started growing raspberries, then we wouldn't have to import raspberries from wherever we import raspberries from. And that's the portion of the $2 billion that gets sent out of state every year. And if raspberries is just an example, if it's eggs or if it's chickens or if it's tomatoes or whatever it is agriculturally that we currently import, the money that is coming out of our pockets to import that food would stay in our local economy. So what is the advantage to reducing a tax burden for people that also equates to less money going out of our community through food purchases out of state? Let me see if we've got a definition for agriculture land.
Yeah, for the record, Donna Ardwin, staff to Representative Carpenter. Two things, Representative Henshute, through the chair. Farming activity and farm use are defined in that in the statute currently, and they're not changed in this bill. They include raising and harvesting crops, feeding, breeding, managing livestock, dairying, or any combination of these activities. One more clarification. In current law, if you put a raspberry bush on your property, we're not changing that part. So the farm assessor, the assessor has to determine whether or not that's truly farm use. And if there's, it makes a difference.
Follow up, Representative Henshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, so I'm concerned by removing a lower threshold, the 10% threshold, that anybody could make a claim of farming. So this definition helps. You have to be raising crops or livestock or providing some sort of a dairy, even if it's a single cow, to qualify as a farm. Because I was thinking, you know, the other standard that I've seen is the $1,000, that $1,000 of your income has to be from farm-related activities to be considered a farm. And in your bill, these changes would take away any threshold to be considered a farm. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Henshute, and this is Representative Carpenter for the record, that is correct. What we're saying is that the dollar figure associated with a commercial venture of what the food production is no longer in the statute. And that's what we're saying.
However, through the chair.
Representative Henshute.
Thank you. You're still having to meet the defined, the statutorily defined threshold of farming by having crops, dairy, or livestock.
Or other land use, I believe. And through the chair, Representative Carpenter to Representative Henshute. That's correct. And the assessor comes out periodically to look at your land. So you can make a claim that you're doing agriculture use or you have ag land. But if you're not actually doing it, then the assessor is not going to agree with your claim that you are using it for agriculture land. So you wouldn't be qualified under that assessor's discretion to have it called ag land.
Follow-up?
Representative.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm concerned about the burden that would place on municipalities and their assessors and that kind of thing. Or, you know, in a fallow year, is that a year that you do pay tax since it's a fallow year? Anyway, I could see some complications with that, so I need to think about it more. But I wanted to move to another section of the bill, which is Section 6, which requires a municipal vote. And I get uncomfortable whenever we require something of municipalities. I come from a district with 21 very small, not all are municipalities, but most are. And any burden that we place on them is a burden. There's just very little capacity in some of these communities to add another thing. So my concern is the requirement to vote. Why is it a requirement versus a suggestion or an option?
Through the chair, to Representative Hinshute, this is Representative Carpenter. The requirement to place the question before the voters is an acknowledgement that in some cases, maybe the status quo doesn't want to change. And all the state is saying, have the conversation with your local constituents that might want to see this change. And this is the how do you overcome the inertia to do nothing conversation that I've been having with a long-term fiscal plan. There are certain things that we can do to incentivize or require conversations to happen. And we recognize that we are in a very precarious situation with regard to food in our state. It is a serious matter. It is not discussed nearly enough. And that is not just the purview of the government to make sure Alaskans have food. It is also the purview of all Alaskans to take food production seriously. So how do you force that conversation to happen when in many instances we have been addicted to buying food from out of state and that model, that way of getting food? How do you change that conversation? Well, this is a proposition to force people to start having a conversation about what can we do to incentivize local food production. Again, we don't live in a place like Korea that maybe forces their people to do something. I'm not suggesting that's what they did in my previous statement. I'm just saying we live in a free country and we're looking at ways to incentivize conversations to happen to get the outcomes that we're needing. So incentivize for a particular outcome.
Through the chair.
Follow up, Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Final follow up. The difference between incentivize and mandate is a fine line. Mm-hmm. And I just have concerns about big government telling people what they have to do. So anytime we impose a mandate, I get a little uncomfortable with that. So I'm going to think about it more because I think your goal is absolutely worthy. And it's the shall and the mandate that are a sticking point for me. So thank you for bringing this, though. We do have room for improvement. On your slides, you didn't have anything about our climate being a barrier. I know we struggle in my region with getting too much water. And so there's certainly a cost to producing our own food. Doesn't mean it's not worthy and doesn't mean in most cases that it's not better food and it's local. So we like that, but it is a skill to be able to raise crops in Southeast Alaska, but not an insurmountable challenge. So thank you.
Through the chair. Just a very brief response. I totally agree. We didn't talk about climate or weather to Alaskans who are probably very familiar with the concept. And there will be no, in the foreseeable future, that Alaskans can prevent or totally replace food importation. There's just certain things that we're not going to be able to grow up here. So, but that doesn't mean that we can't grow what we can. And any portion of $2 billion that stays in the state because we're producing more of our food is good for each one of our economies at the local level.
Any additional questions or comments? Okay, nothing from the, Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair, and sorry that I had to step out there for a second. Thank you, Representative Carpenter, for this bill. I think it's a great step in a good direction. One question that I did have was on the processing that would be required for Alaskan-grown, particularly Alaska-grown meat products. If there was an entity who wished to develop, let's say, a chicken farm and then have processing attached to that, would the processing plant be able to apply for this tax incentive under this proposal?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, the bill removes the requirement that in order to benefit from a property tax reduction, that it is a commercial operation. So both an individual family and a business would be treated the same under the assessment and the under the assessment at least. The local municipality may decide to treat it differently through their tax rates, but at least through the assessment, they would treat ag land as ag land.
Thank you.
Any follow-up questions? Okay. Hearing none. Representative Carpenter, did you have any closing remarks that you'd like to make before we set this aside?
Well, I guess the final thing that I would say is that we have the capacity to grow more food in the state of Alaska. The question is, do we have the will? It's difficult, speaking as a guy who put 4,000 peony roots in the ground. It's not easy, but it is rewarding. And to the extent that our government can encourage that behavior in our people, we will be a healthier, stronger, more resilient people if we do that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this bill today.
Thank you for your presentation this morning, Representative Carpenter. We will now take a brief at ease to just make sure that we have everything in order for our next presenter. Brief at ease. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. I hope you enjoyed the hold music on television while we transition. We now welcome Senator Dunbar to the table. He is joined by staff, Arielle Wiggin. If you please begin your presentation. Put your name on the record and begin your presentation. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Forrest Dunbar, Senator for District J.
This is Arielle Wiggins, Chief of Staff to Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee for hearing this joint resolution. It was passed by the Senate several weeks ago. SGR 13 supports the Alaska Native Village Municipal Lands Restoration Act of 2023, which was introduced by our federal delegation, supported by all three, Senator Murkowski, Sullivan, and Congresswoman Peltola. Sort of simply put, that federal legislation attempts to address a challenge in ANCSA that was unanticipated at passage. Section 14C3 of ANCSA set aside certain lands to be held in state trust for future municipalities. Unfortunately, in a lot of these small communities, those municipalities don't exist. They haven't incorporated. They aren't anticipated to incorporate. The last time it happened, I believe, was 1995. So there are about 11,500 acres currently sitting in state trust that would be better held, and our congressional delegation believes should be held by Alaska Native Village corporations. So I'll give you the example of Chiniga in Prince William Sound, which is not too far where I grew up. Chiniga, of course, was devastated in the earthquake. There aren't a lot of folks living in Chiniga. The establishment of a new town in Chiniga is unlikely. But there are acres, including the old cemetery and some of the best lands near where the village center used to be, that are now being held in the state trust. And it's very difficult for those lands to be developed. And so the Chiniga Corporation would love to turn those into housing and try to, you know, recreate basically this or help grow this village. So again, there are 11,500 acres throughout the state that are in this status, and we'd like to see them returned to the Alaska Native Village corporations and communities. And we have several folks online that can speak to this more eloquently and more depth than I can, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. So I see we have Benjamin Malott on the line, Marjorie Mary, and Greg
Renkes.
Renkes, thank you. Is there any particular order that you would?
I think former Attorney General Renkes might be a good one to start with.
Great. Okay. Mr. Renkes, if you can unmute, go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Senator Dunbar, and thank you, Chair McCormick, and the members of the House Regional Affairs Committee. Really appreciate you hearing SJR 13 today, and we really appreciate Senator Dunbar's interest in seeing this resolution passed out of the Senate, I think by a vote of 19 to nothing. My name is Greg Renkes. I work as the Chiniga Corporation as their Senior Vice President for Government Relations. I also serve as an alternate on the board of Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. And Chiniga is a village, Alaska Native Village Corporation, formed under AGSA. The village of Chiniga is located on just a little addendum to Senator Dunbar's introduction. The village actually was relocated on Evans Island in the 80s and is about 100 miles from Anchorage. And these 14 seed lands are located in that relocated village location. Thank you for an opportunity to say a few words. Expressing the Alaska State Legislature's support for passage by Congress of this bill, which is called the Alaska Native Village Municipal Lands Restoration Act of 2023, will be very helpful in moving along. The legislation has already received the support of the governor and the Alaska Federation of Natives. Ben Malott's on today to talk a little bit about that, and the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. The Senate bill has had a hearing and was favorably reported out of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources on December 14th. The House bill, introduced by Representative Peltola, still needs to attract the interest of the House Natural Resources Committee and receive a hearing date working on that. Congressman Ryan Zinke of Montana, the former Secretary of the Interior, and Congressman Stauber from Minnesota, the Vice Chair of the Western Caucus, have signed on as co-sponsors of Representative Peltola's bill in the House. This resolution, along with the governor's support, will really help our congressional delegation push this process along with the hope of seeing it become law by the end of the 118th Congress. And I'll just go into a little bit about what the bill does in more detail. The federal legislation addresses, as Senator Dunbar mentioned, the loose end. I call it a loose end left behind by ANGSA. You know, no legislation is perfect when written, and ANGSA has been amended many times over the last 50 years to improve its impact and address unintended consequences. And this is just one of those cases where unintended consequences of the act, really only visible with the passage of time, need to be addressed. Section 14C3 of ANGSA required every Native Village Corporation formed under the act to turn a portion of the lands it received over to the state of Alaska to be held in trust for the eventual creation of a municipal government. Many village corporations, but less than half actually, turned over land to the state as required. And in a few cases, that land has become municipal lands where municipalities were formed. However, in the case of the vast majority of villages, the land is still being managed in apparent perpetuity by the state municipal land trust. Decades after the passage of ANGSA, many years after these village corporations turned over land, Senator Dunbar pointed out, no municipalities have been created and none are in sight. The state has administered the federal program for nearly 50 years, and there have been only 8 ANGSA villages that have formed a new municipality, as was mentioned, the last 1995. perpetual management of these lands, state trust, was not envisioned by the crafters of ANCSA. The provision should have included an expiration date, but it didn't. It is time to return these lands to those village corporations. They can own and manage the lands for the benefit of their community members and their shareholders, thanks intended. The Municipal Land Trust, as was mentioned, holds approximately 11,550 acres, and it's nearly impossible to develop these lands for things like housing due to restrictions imposed by the state's fiduciary responsibility to a future yet unknown municipality. Importantly, these lands were required to be the improved land, quoting from the statute now, the improved land on which the native village is located and as much additional land as is necessary for community expansion and appropriate rights of way for public use and other foreseeable community needs. The lands are in the village where housing and community infrastructure should be built by design and largely blocked from the. So this is really quite a problem, even though it's not a large amount of land. Small amounts of land in each village that are affected are important. Once ANCSA became law, the BLM pushed to get ANCSA 14C3 settled. In the early 1980s, some communities transferred deeds, and the momentum of that federal effort to implement the law, the state received the bulk of the land held in trust today during that push. There are 83 communities across Alaska that still have their land tied up today in the Municipal Land Trust program. Some village corporations defied the law and never transferred land into the trust. Other than the early push by the BLM, there really was no enforcement mechanism at the state level to require participation. However, a cloud on title remains on lands held by village corporations who fail to participate. Any development use on these lands requires the state's written disclaimer of interest that engages in a conversation about putting lands into the trust. So it really is a problem that cuts across not only the 83 communities that are part of the trust today, but all of those village corporations and communities that would like to develop their lands but never participated in the trust have to deal with this cloud on title. Chinita currently has approximately 385 acres of land in the Municipal Land Trust. Most of the core lands in the Chinita Village are held in trust. The topography and wetlands on Evans Island severely limit available developable lands, making the lack of developable land a severe problem. But looking at the future development sites, many of the buildable areas fall within lands held by the state trust. And as Senator Dunbar mentioned, even the village cemetery is held in trust. This undermines Chinita's right to self-determination and self-governance. While some of this land is subject to municipal land trust lease agreements to accommodate public facilities, these leases are subject to fees and are cumbersome to update or amend to accommodate community needs. Chinita should control these settlement lands, not the state of Alaska. Most critically, the municipal land trust program prevents Chinita from improving the community with additional housing, particularly needed workforce housing, and creating economic opportunity for the residents. Legislation introduced by our delegation in Congress includes the following four basic elements. The village corporation conveyed all required land to the state, and the property conveyed to the state and trust reverts back to the village corporation. The village corporation conveyed only a portion of their required lands, those lands would be returned. The village corporation has not conveyed lands to the state, the requirement is eliminated, cloud of their title goes away. And then a reversion of the lands to the village corporations is subject to all valid existing rights created by the Municipal Land Trust. Village corporations assume all obligations regarding those lands, and the state has no ongoing liability with respect to those lands. With the benefit of 50-year hindsight, we can see that the failure of the ANCSA Municipal Land Trust to provide situations where municipalities would not be formed or include a sunset provision has resulted in hurting, not helping, the affected communities. These unintended consequences left by a legislative loose end need to be addressed to fulfill the promise of ANCSA and importantly allow for desperately needed economic opportunity and housing in small communities across the state. And with that, I'll finish, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your remarks. Are there any questions, Representative McCabe?
Thank you, Mr. And through the chair, Mr. Ranke's Representative McCabe, for the record. I'm curious, the lands that are held in the Municipal Land Trust, the state of Alaska, I mean, are we supposed to be managing those lands like, you know, the timber sales for expedited timber sales where, you know, the beetle kill problems are rampant? I mean, are we sort of the stewards, and are we taking the correct care, do you think, of these lands for the eventual transfer back or to?
Well, so these lands are, you know, largely, not entirely, but Kansas City, that was certainly, but largely not resource lands because they were required to be located really at the center of these communities. But the state has taken that position, I think rightly so. They have a legal obligation as a fiduciary to a future municipality not to allow any use of these lands that would predetermine their uses by a future municipality. So really, the lands are just tied up until a municipality is formed, and then the municipality can go forward. Now, there have been some exceptions. Like there are, in a couple cases, not many, but in a couple cases around the state, there's a 14C, there's a lease of this 14C trust land for an airstrip, local airport. And so because that's a public use, that would be the interest of a future municipality, so the Municipal Land Trust has allowed that to occur. But largely, it's been the safest, most conservative legal path for the state has been to allow very limited, if not no use of these lands so that they would be intact for a future potential municipality.
Follow-up, Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. I guess what I was, maybe I'll rephrase that a little bit. What I was thinking of is we have a fiduciary diligence or fiduciary responsibility, I guess, to things that are sort of left in our care, not to just let them burn. I mean, you know, certainly if we didn't, and what I'm getting at is forest fires, obviously, sorry, Senator, but forest fires, wildfires, that sort of thing, we have spent in this body in the last 2 years a good amount of time trying to find a way to mitigate the cost to the state and the cost of losing trees and land by proper forest management. And I'm just wondering if these lands are sort of in that same boat where we could maybe go in and thin out the timber a little bit and cut the beetle kill spruce away and make sure that the land itself is resource is there and available for when we finally do turn it over.
Yeah, through the chair. Yes, as the fiduciary, the state does have the responsibility to protect and manage the lands and keep them in the best possible shape for future municipalities. So there would be, you know, proactive measures to protect lands would be part of the responsibility of the state as fiduciary. I don't think this has come up because I really don't think much of the 11,550 acres of the trust really are timbered in large part. I think they're mostly vacant lands in the centers of the small village communities.
Thanks.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, a couple of questions for Mr. Renke's. The first one is, was the original intent in having state land in these communities, and I'm sorry if this was already explained, but was the original intent that if the need for a city property arose, so for a court building or some other state function in the community, that the land would be available for that? Was that the purpose of it originally?
Yes.
Okay. And then through the chair, follow-up?
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. I'm looking at a slide that came from the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development with these communities and a key. Some of these communities have completed reconveyance. Does that mean that the state land that was held in trust now is no longer state land, it's with that community, versus completed with no MLT lands? So there are various, each of these communities has a different status, and I'm just curious, if this bill were to pass, then whatever the status of each of those communities is, they all would, like, basically it would erase these various different levels of conveyance. Is that correct? It would just remove the state ownership and return it to the communities listed.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, that's correct. Regardless of whether there's been a partial conveyance to the trust or a full conveyance of the obligation of the village corporation of the trust, no conveyance, or all village corporations would be put back on the same footing in control of their lands in these communities where municipalities have not been.
Senator Dunbar, did you have?
I just want to make a brief comment, and I don't want to interrupt Mr. Chair Rep. Himshute's questions with Mr. Rankis, but I would just point out that there's also someone from AFN online, and if we get a chance to hear from them too, I think it would be wise.
Thank you. Representative Himshute, did you have a follow-up?
I just have a general question for, as more people testify, something that I'm curious about. So I guess through the chair, it is a follow-up. As we continue the conversation, there's a huge struggle to place fish and game biologists, teachers, various functions of the state in some of these remote places. And so if we return the land, which I believe I support this bill, are we losing the opportunity to put a bunkhouse so that we can actually house a trooper or a VPSO or whatever? So if that could be addressed either by this speaker or the future speakers, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, I can address that. So actually now that's not possible because it's not a use of the land that would be appropriate for a future municipality at this point in time. But housing is one of the critical needs. And if this land can go back to the village corporations, it will actually free them up for this type of workforce housing development that's really needed.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. I think we'll move on to some of our other invited testimony. Senator Dunbar, did you have a comment? No. Okay. So I think we'll hear now from Vice President Malott. Oh, and on video. Thank you for joining us. Please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and McCormick. Based on the feedback and questions that Greg got, my testimony is very short. I think Marjorie Mary, who is also online here, Marjorie has true feet on the ground with the MLT, with my mother's home village of Rampart, with dealing with the 14C3 trust issue and the MLT. So if it's okay with you and the committee, I'd like to have Marjorie go first, but she has some very, very good insights of how this works on the ground with the MLT and our village corporations and how that affects the sustainability of our communities.
Absolutely. Miss Mary, if you're if you can unmute, please go right ahead.
Good morning, Chair McCormick and members of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony in support of SJR 13. My name is Marjorie Mary, and I am president of Banal Yilkon Corporation, the Yangtze Village Corporation for the federally recognized tribe, Rampart Village. And I am a tribal member of Rampart Village, of course. Pursuant to ANCSA, each qualified Alaskan Native who enrolled with the Department of the Interior to the Village of Rampart was entitled to shares of stock in Banal Yilkon Corporation, 174 qualified individuals enrolled to Rampart Village, and we now have more than 200 shareholders, many who still reside in Rampart Village. The Rampart Village Council serves as a governing body of our community and maintains the community power plant, washateria, school, health clinic, communications equipment, road service, landfill, and all other services that a typical municipality would assume in any city or town across America. Ban Oyokan supports the Rampart Tribal Council in every way that we can to improve and enhance the health, safety, and well-being of our ancestral community, as all shareholders are members of the Rampart Tribe. Rampart, located on the banks of the Yukon River, approximately 125 air miles north of Fairbanks, was the center of the Yukon River Gold Rush as early as 1897. That gold mining pass left a legacy of private landholders in our town center, and later a ring of native allotments around the privately held lands. The formula provided for in ANCSA Section 14C3 has proved problematic to our corporation since the passage of the law. Ban Oyokan Corporation has always supported the village, but our lands lie far outside the city center, with the exception of a small number of acres along the riverfront. 50 years ago, it was difficult for us to envision where and what bona fide municipal use of our lands would be required by a future municipality. And as a result, we chose not to complete our selection of ANCSA Section 14C3 lands. That is not to say that we have not provided lands to our village council for bona fide municipal use. Instead, Ban Oyokan Corporation has chosen to provide those lands through leases indirectly to the council or with transfer of deed via quitclaim. Most recently, we attempted to support the Rampart Village Council with 10 acres of land selected with the assistance of the State Department of Environmental Conservation for the development of a new community landfill. The Rampart Village Council has struggled to provide a safe and sanitary landfill for our community for many years. The Rampart Village Council was able to obtain EPA grant funds that would build the road 4 miles out to the new approved site. I contacted the Municipal Trust Department and worked out a plan to transfer those 10 acres into the trust for that bona fide municipal purpose. But unfortunately, after years of fruitless negotiation, excessive legal costs, countless emails, and meeting expenses, the Municipal Trust Department decided they would not accept our parcels. Ban Oyokan Corporation had no other recourse except to transfer the deed via quitclaim directly to the council, as well as a portion of land we held adjacent to the airport that would allow the council access to a gravel site and the development of a new baseball park. Ban Oyokan Corporation wishes to comply with all the terms of ANCSA. We also have a duty to our shareholders and to our community. The Municipal Trust Department has always been understaffed and underfunded. Leases for lands placed into trust for village council uses have taken 6 to 9 months to be written and approved. Land selections take years to be accepted into the trust and drain corporation and council's meager resources. In my opinion, the management of the Municipal Trust has been a major impediment to rural Alaska economic development. Ban Oyokan urges full consideration of SJR 13 and ultimately its passage into law. If the legislation passes, Ban Oyokan Corporation will continue to work hand in hand to fulfill land requirements of our tribe for the betterment of our community. Without the additional constraints and lackadaisical management of the Municipal Trust thwarting our growth, health, safety, and wellness of the people who live in our community today. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak to you today on this important issue.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Mary. Vice President Malott, I know we just had you on, but I think you had some remarks that you wanted to give. Then I'll go ahead and open up the committee for questions again.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to go real fast? Just to clarify, okay. For the record, my name is Ben Lott. I have the honor of serving as Vice President of AFN, the Alaska Natives. AFN has long supported the 14C3 provisions and association within Congress. And I guess one of the beautiful things about going last is that most of the big talking points have already been covered, so I won't go over what Greg and Marjorie have said. AFN has long supported the 14C3 legislation within Congress. AFN and through our delegates have passed multiple resolutions, the most recent one being 2317 from last year, which actually sponsored by Ben Newcon from Marjorie, that urges Congress to restore lands conveyed under the Alaska Native Payment Sun Act 14C3 provision. This resolution 2317 demonstrates that AFN's membership comprising of 179 tribes, 154 British corporations, 9 Swedish corporations, 10 regional nonprofit tribal consortiums, is unified in support of finding remedy for the 14C3 issue. As Greg mentioned, as Mary Marjorie has mentioned, the 14C3 issue is a long term problem. Is an era is a problem that's long past. And working within AFN, within Congress, working with Greg, and also past previous legislation within Congress and previous Congresses, having the state unified with our Alaskan corporations and our villages makes a big difference. In the past, you know, you go to Congress, staff would say we're state on this, and we got kind of like, but I think this year with government support and this resolution, also want to recognize Senator Dunbar for support of this resolution, is a big step forward. So with that said, I'll keep my comments brief. Greg and Marge are the true experts in this, but I just want to say, Vinakshree Anabasi, for your assertion of this resolution and support for the 14C3 provision.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Vice President Malott. And I would be remiss if I also did not thank you for the immense amount of work that you do for people of the state. So thank you for that as well. Are there any questions? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. And through the chair, it's just a general question. I'm not sure, maybe Senator Dunbar, you can direct the answer to the appropriate person. But so my understanding of this, and apologies if this was already mentioned and I had to step out, but is that the initial 14C3 provision was in place in order to encourage or put an incentive out there for incorporation. And after incorporation, those lands that were held in trust would then be granted over to the incorporated place. Eight villages have done that, it sounds like, according to testimony thus far. What is the barrier? What is the thing that has been in place for so long that other villages and other areas have said, we really don't want to do that or can't do that? What is the barrier there?
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, and perhaps Mr. Rankis also wanted to speak to this. I think it's so eight since the creation of ANCSA, so eight over the course of many decades, and the last one being in 1995. And I think that a number of you who have lived in rural Alaska, you know, can appreciate part of it is the population isn't growing there, right? And we have, it takes a certain amount of sophistication and revenue base and everything else to create a municipal government. So when we talk about incorporation, we're talking about some form of municipal government, not Anchorage or something like that, but, you know, a small town. And this goes also to what Representative Hinchu was talking about, you know, the lands were specifically for that, you know, building a school or building something else. I said schools in most cases already are built, but some other form of a municipal facility, right? And I'll just speak from my own personal experience. You know, we do have a town out in Eagle, but when I was there in the early 90s, there was 150 people. Now there's 80, you know, and it's sort of a chicken and the egg problem too, right? Because as the testimony sort of laid out, it's very difficult to work with the state to build housing, for example, the kind of things you'd need to spur the population growth, to spur the incorporation are exactly the kind of things that the MLT has, for whatever reason, been unwilling or unable under the fiduciary duty to do. And so I think that is largely part of the issue. But I obviously my colleagues probably have other insight.
Sure. Thank you.
Do any of our Mr. Rinkes, did you have any comment on that? You just appeared on the screen. I'm not sure if that was...
Yes, to the chair. I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to add something or not, but sorry I wasn't on video earlier. It's nice to see Juno on my screen. But, lack of capacity and the cost of setting up municipal government, it's just really awkward for small villages. And some other local form of government, often, tribes have now taken over some of those responsibilities. Often the village corporations have taken them too, but they've just found more efficient, less costly ways to meet their local needs out without the costs associated, the capacity needs associated with forming a municipal government.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions?
I got just one quick
one. Representative McKay, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just looking at, there's a letter in our packet from Governor Dunleavy encouraging this to happen, so I don't think this is fine. There's one sentence. Urge you to introduce and pursue passage of legislation to revoke the TAPS land withdrawal. That's the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. I guess we've talked a lot about the villages. I looked at the list in here. I just wonder, how does this affect the pipeline? Just curious.
Representative McKay, through the chair. I don't believe that it does. I think that might be a request for a broader revision of ANCSA, but I could be mistaken. Mr. Rankis, do you have any insight into that?
I do. I can speak to that. That letter, the governor was addressing several issues that were sort of loose ends from ANILCA and ANCSA that locked up lands in the state. The public land order it's actually called PLO 5160, but the public land order that reserved land for TAPS is still in place, and it blocks about 2 million acres of prime state selections that can't be completed. That issue has absolutely nothing to do with ANCSA 14C 3, and the lands in these villages are completely separate, but the governor was including several issues in one letter.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thank you. One last call. Are there any further questions? All right. Well, Senator Dunbar, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I cannot express enough how I think this addresses really a crisis in rural Alaska, and that is the need for housing. And so I would just say that it is my intention to really move this as quickly as possible. And so if there's any issues that the members of this committee have, please make it known. Otherwise, it's my intent to move this at our next meeting if possible. So, Senator Dunbar, do you have any closing remarks before we set this aside?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. This Community Regional Affairs Committee will meet again on Tuesday, March 11th at 8 a.m. The time is 9:33 a.m. in this hearing. The Community Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned.